Life insurers put life into the things you live for. The new factory that's hiring your neighbors. Maintenance on the bridge that keeps traffic flowing. The paycheck that puts pizza night on the table. Life insurers contribute $8 trillion to communities and local economies through bond purchases and other investments. And protect the financial security of 90 million American families. Like yours. See how life insurers put life into America at ACLI.com. Paid for by the American Council of Life Insurers.
Welcome to Birch Lane, where you can find a fresh take on classic furniture and decor. Every piece is hand-picked and crafted to last for years to come. At Birch Lane, you can explore everything from outdoor sets to living room furniture and everything in between. And get fast, free shipping. It's classic style for joyful living. Shop now at birchlane.com.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, setting up a supplement brand and starting a women's health movement, I'll be meeting the female team behind Sisterly. We'll be tackling the sticky topic of relationships and money with financial expert Nick Charalambos, and therapist Fiona Brennan is back to answer a listener issue on fertility. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'm exhausted, I'd have to say. When can I go on holiday again? I think I might need to just lie on a beach in Spain for a week every 3 weeks if I'm expected to keep all of these spinning plates going. But look, I'm good. We've got the house hunting and bidding, the kids. I'm embarking on another ADHD support mission. There are exams coming up, end of summer exams for the kids. Work is flying. So I'm trying to get rest in as and when I can. It's quite good that we have the Spanish weather. I will say that. That's helping, but there doesn't seem to be much time to lie down on a beach. A close friend of our family died this week. We had her funeral, so that was an end of an era for sure. Myself and her daughter had become friends in primary school, and our mums really hit it off while they were in the kitchen drinking coffee and chatting, and we'd be out playing in the garden. And while we drifted to different secondary schools, we did remain friends, but our mums became besties and our families interlinked forevermore. So that was a sad point for us all this week. And to have that time come to an end, she will be very much missed. And I was at Wellfest last weekend. I hosted a panel on gut health for Simprove with nutritionist Rachel Young and Tricia Lewis, who is just always a ball of energy. She was so open and honest about her health journey and had the tent in stitches. So she's just a fantastic, fantastic person to be around. Thank you to all of you who came to say hello and say that you listen to the show. It's always a joy to meet you. And on Sunday, I headed to a retreat day of yoga, food, nature and slowing down. Knockanaman is in Roundwood in Wicklow. It's named after the matriarchal land that it sits on, and it's well worth paying a visit to. They do have an Instagram page for all upcoming events. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Sisterly is a supplement brand set up by three women, Aoife Matthews, Jennifer O'Connell and Louise O'Riordan, who walked away from corporate careers to not only energise women with their brand, but to start a movement when it comes to the research gap in women's health. And two of the trio join me in studio now, Aoife and Jennifer. You're both very welcome. So how do the three of you know each other originally?
So Aoife and I were introduced through my older sister, and we were chatting about all things Sisterly, and I had a great friend living in LA called Louise O'Riordan, and I said, we should really get on to Louise. I knew her from my time in New York. Aoife came out with the immortal line, I know Louise, we used to live together in London.
Yeah, so myself and Louise, I lived in London for many years working in banking, and Louise actually shared an apartment with me for a while. So, but I hadn't really seen her for some time because she was living in LA. And then through Jenny and through Jenny's sister, we all reconnected, which was fabulous.
So you two had already been having a discussion about possibly setting up a supplement brand. I mean, what was the seed of that discussion?
Well, to be honest, it was more, this was during COVID. And we were all, you know, we'd reconnected. We were all chatting about our health and how we support each other, I suppose, mainly with immunity. But then also, you know, I was in my mid-40s coming into perimenopause. And I had just done a qualification as a female health and wellness coach. And so became very aware of, you know, that we should be supporting our bodies. And we started this conversation about like what supplements should we be taking, knowing that food doesn't do it all. And it really led from there. You know, I was based in Madrid at the time. Jenny was in Dublin. Louise was in LA. And we started delving more into female health and the lack of product that's out there, the lack of research that's done. And it really led on from there.
And did you really walk away from your jobs to do this, or was that starting to come anyway? I think everybody in the pandemic was like, what am I doing with my life? Was it part of that too?
So I was working as a barrister. And there isn't much time in the day to do anything else. But during the pandemic, things obviously slowed down. And I think had it not been for the pandemic, I wonder would we have ever gotten the momentum going that we managed to achieve during that time. And Aoife went full time first in the business and was working for about a year full time. And then I joined her in July of 23. I left the bar, which was a huge step, a scary step.
And the whole thing must have been scary because I'm really fascinated. Supplements is a hugely saturated market. How did you get over the hump of how can we do this? There's already so many people doing it already. That fascinates me.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people did say that. You know, it is. There's a lot of supplements out there. Why would you try and go into that market? But, you know, there's a lot of supplements out there, but it's such an overwhelming market. And yet people are still asking, our friends were saying, what should we take? What's good? What's bad? I had a whole shelf of supplements that I wasn't actually taking. You know, you hear all, get recommendations from social media, from friends, whatever. You buy into all this stuff and then you don't actually take it because maybe it's capsules or you're taking too much or, you know, you're busy. And then things don't work and they gather dust. And, you know, Jenny was the same. Louise was the same. We found so many of our friends were the same that it wasn't, you know, they didn't know if supplements were working. There's such a, I don't know, they didn't know what brands to trust. And we felt, look, if we can't find something that works for us as women, why don't we go out and see if we can make something?
So you were going completely into the unknown. You were 3 years in development. I mean, that's huge.
And that took us, well, I suppose we were probably a bit naive. We thought we would come to market sooner. We didn't realise how complicated it was. But the most important thing for us was, you know, what we say this to you, but it wasn't, don't worry that we didn't actually develop it, or we didn't formulate it ourselves. You know, you wouldn't trust a banker, a barrister and a brand developer to develop your supplement. So the most important thing for us was bringing on a really crack team of doctors, scientists and female health experts. So that's what we did. And that took us, you know, time to get the right people on board.
And was that when you started to become aware of the research gap when it comes to women's health, or were you already well versed in that?
Well, I think through the coaching that I had done or the training that I did, I became very well aware of it then. And then when we started all looking into it and doing further research, surveying women, you know, as to what their needs were, it became very clear that the statistics are shocking. And I think it really gets our goat up, you know, that there's so little there for women. You know, less than 5% of all healthcare money is spent on female-specific issues, yet more women are prone to cardiac arrest, more women are prone to Alzheimer's, more, you know, we have PMS. You know, there's so many stats out there that where women suffer more, yet the research just isn't there.
Yeah, some of the stats would really frighten you, wouldn't they? I mean, the idea that the ingredients that are in Viagra were found to have been really effective with endometriosis symptoms, which is massive. Women wait an average of 9 years to get a diagnosis, and it can be hugely debilitating on their quality of life and their fertility and beyond. And yet it was decided to funnel it towards Viagra instead. And I'm not saying erectile dysfunction isn't important and shouldn't be tackled as well as, but when it's an either or, the male issue is often favoured. And that's a lot to take on, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, that the idea that, you know, there's 19% of men who suffer from erectile dysfunction, and then there's, you know, there's five times more spend on research into that area than on menstrual issues, which affect 80% of women. It's just wild. It makes no sense at all. And I think that's why we are really passionate about this. And the whole endometriosis piece is huge for us as well. And, you know, PCOS, you know, the time of the month, ignoring our hormone cycle is so stupid. We need to, you know, look specifically at what the female body needs and find tailored solutions for the female body. And that's what we're all about at Sisterly.
Because we've been told that to take part in clinical trials is more challenging because we have a menstrual cycle and because, so therefore we have fluctuating hormones. So it's harder to get a direct read. And there is a chance of us getting pregnant. And to be on a clinical trial, say with medication, there could be implications for the fetus, and that is understandable. But it's a challenge, but it doesn't mean it's impossible. You know, the decision has just been made, so we won't really do it. And again, I don't think that's good enough.
And I think it was 1994, they had to introduce legislation in the US to make it compulsory that you have women in clinical trials, because it had become so the norm to leave them out of clinical trials because of just what you're describing. So that's led to a huge bias in the research in terms of our understanding of what dosages suit women or what pharma, you know, how it impacts the female body. And I think you have to recognise we're 50% of the population. How these things impact us is as important as anybody else. And proactive steps need to be taken to ensure that the impact on women is understood. We've worked with an amazing lady called Dr. Lisa Ryan from the Atlantic Technological University, and she speaks internationally on concussion syndrome and how it impacts women differently, because the concussion protocols are all built around men and the symptoms suffered by men, whereas women suffer very different symptoms when they're concussed, but they're just as likely to be concussed on the ski slopes or in a camogie match or in a sporting accident. But we don't. So when somebody runs onto the pitch, they're going off a protocol that's all built around the male response to concussion. It's the same around heart attacks. You know, women experience a heart attack in a different way to men. They can experience nausea instead of that tightness in the chest. But yet, in every A&E room and in every film, you see people clutching their chests when they're having a heart attack. So it's understanding those differences. We talk about Dr. Stacey Sims. She has this great book called Roar. And her phrase, which we love, is women are not small men. So understanding that piece of the puzzle is so important. And that's why we really wanted to focus on female health specifically, rather than a one size fits all.
Yeah, and I mean, that small men piece, aside from looking into specialised women's issues, there have been so many ramifications, from the seatbelt being set up for men to dosages of medication, having women falling asleep at the wheel because we've been assumed to be small men. It really does boggle the mind. So this has become more than a supplement brand. This is a bit of a movement. So you're planning events, you have a podcast in the works, because you want to really start this conversation and move the dial a little bit.
Yeah. So we do lots of female health events, phenomenal events where we get women out, and we love, you know, getting them out doing yoga or running or cycling. We did a phenomenal, again, I give credit to Jenny for this, we did a phenomenal Sisterly Spin, which was a cycling event for women. And, you know, we had, I think, 50 women there. We went off for a cycle through Wicklow. And we had Annalise Murphy and Sonia O'Sullivan and Becky Woods talking about their stories. And it's just phenomenal when you get women together, the energy and the love and then the awareness. It's brilliant.
I saw you speak at an event, Aoife, and you highlighted it was women taking more time for themselves.
Yes. This was a lady, we don't know who she is, but she sent us in a review saying she was 55. She was a nurse, a mother, a farmer. You know, busy woman, saying that she realised she was spending more, you know, on the kids and the animals than she every week than she was on herself. And she told us that now it reminds her, she takes it every morning, and it reminds her that she has a worth, that she has that little ritual in the morning where it's her me time and she has a value. And I thought that was so moving. You know, and isn't it awful that women feel that they don't have value, that they're looking after everybody else, doing all the jobs, working hard, looking after the kids and whatnot, and not taking the time out to look after themselves. And having that little, you know, maybe even just 5 minutes in the morning for yourself, supporting your health. And then, you know, it's setting yourself up for the day. So when we hear from women like that, you know, it really makes everything worthwhile.
Yeah, I think that is so important, that 5 minutes to yourself, because often I feel in this health and wellness conversation, it's a big, massive change that people think they need to undertake, a complete overhaul, whereas it can start as small as that. But it really speaks to the conversation, as Aoife just said there, of what women are taking on. And I hear it time and time again. We were told we could have it all, and instead we just started to do it all. So it is a big part of your message to tell women that they have a worth. Talk to me about the hard graft then. I've witnessed firsthand the amount that you're doing, Aoife. We've been laughing before we came to air about how often I've met you, because any event I'm at, you're there. You're not just behind the scenes pushing the pen. You're out. You're meeting people. You're sampling. You're at Wellfest all weekend. We're talking weekends, Sundays. How are you managing to make sure that you are drinking your own Kool-Aid, as they say, and not running yourself into the ground?
You know, it is really it is hard. You know, I think we're all probably working harder than we ever worked before. But it's so different when it's your own business and you're so passionate. And we love what we do. And even when it gets really tough, it's all the hard work, you know, it pays off. And I think our families are really supportive as well. I mean, I have two boys and a daughter. My daughter is all into this. You know, she's taking over the business in the future. Sorry, girls. So it's just a passion of ours.
And this is very much only the beginning. I know you got into Harrods, which is really exciting, but there's lots more still to come, isn't there?
There's a lot more to come. So, you know, that means, and we're not limiting ourselves to Ireland or the UK. And we don't want to, you know, we were given some advice at one point that a lot of businesses drown in the Atlantic on the way to the US. So we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We're being kind of very responsible at kind of as we approach all this, but we've big ambitions.
Brendan Courtney, when we were together recently, asked, was there ever going to be a Mr. Lee? But for now, you're looking after the sisterhood and you're doing a great job there. Where can people find you?
So we are online, sisterlylab.com. We are in Brown Thomas in Planet Beauty. We're in Morris Pharmacies, and we're in the UK, a few other sites as well. But in the UK, then we're in Harrods and we're in Whole Foods in Kensington.
Good stuff. Well, Aoife and Jennifer O'Connell and Aoife Matthews of Sisterly, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, clinical hypnotherapist Fiona Brennan is back for her therapy from the couch session. Every 6 weeks or so, she takes on a listener query. It's all confidential. And if you would like to have one answered, you can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Fiona, you're very welcome back.
Thank you, Claire.
How have you been?
I'm in great form, thank you.
Okay, good. Because was it around the last time we were talking a lot about grief because you just lost your dad? So you're coming out of the darkness a little. It'll never go away, but are things feeling lighter a little?
They are, Claire, to be honest. Yes. And interestingly enough, on the grief front, I think it is something that probably is a lifelong journey. But I do feel that the more I am in a positive, happy, content state, the closer I feel to my dad, which is very interesting. And so I suppose I focus on that as much as I can and feel his love and presence every day.
Yeah, sure. I was away in Spain a couple of weeks ago and I don't know what made me think of my dad. Something just hit me and it hits you with a wave that I'd love to speak to him and I'd love to tell him. And you can feel yourself welling up and just out of nowhere, you know, and then you just kind of smile and move on. It, you know, it's ever there.
It's ever there. Yeah.
Now, this is an interesting one. This is something you deal with in clinic all of the time and something that you have dealt with personally. So let's read it to the listeners, because I know myself, it's happening for a lot of people and I think your advice is going to help many. So the listener says, "Dear Claire and Fiona, I'm not sure what to do as I feel totally overwhelmed. I have just been through my second round of IVF. We got the news yesterday that it was not successful and I'm heartbroken and exhausted. I had such high hopes as all the early signs for this round were looking positive and it seems like such a massive disappointment. I don't know if I should keep going. My husband is supportive, but the pressure that this has put on us both emotionally and financially is hard to deal with. I'm 38 now, and while the clinic tell me I'm still young, I feel old. I want to get back to living my life and not for everything to be centred around clinics, scans, medication and injections. What do you think is the next best step?" Does that make you remember? I mean, you have a near adult son now, Luca, but I bet that still speaks very much to your heart because that's something you went through before you ended up becoming a mom to him.
Yes, absolutely. And like, you know, it's something so personal, but also so professional because I've helped many women go through this and men and fathers navigate this journey. And that understanding, it's like so many things, Claire, when you have that lived experience, you're in a very strong position to understand, you know, and have genuine insights into what it's like. And I think that, you know, certainly back now, Lucas, he's 17 and he's literally like, you know, I swear to God, the day I found out I was pregnant, it is definitely the happiest day of my life. I was one of the very, very blessed. And I never, never forget that, you know, just how fortunate I am. But in terms of having a second child, I went through that and the disappointments. So, you know, it's something that I totally do understand. But in terms of what it's like, unless you have someone very close to you that you love, like maybe a sister or best friend or someone that you really are very close to, or indeed, of course, yourself personally, you're not going to really know just how much of a roller coaster it is. And it is because it touches a person, in particular the mother, the woman, or the sort of the mother to be, or hopefully to be, in so many ways. It touches her emotionally, obviously, psychologically, physically. It's a huge thing in terms of the body and the hormones and all of that that's going through your system. And then, of course, there's also the financial component, which puts pressure on a couple. So essentially, it's a roller coaster that you can be thrown off at any point. It's not like a roller coaster with a destination. And one of the hardest parts of it is, and that's what I really work with my clients going through it, is sort of the lack of control that you have. So you can do everything right, if you like. You can tick all the boxes. You can, be so healthy and, you know, dedicated, etc. Timing your intimacy, doing everything that you can. And you can still not get that successful outcome that you really, really want. And I think it's worth saying, you know, to this listener, you know, that she's at a very pivotal point in terms of that disappointment, and how, you know, it's really hard when you want something so viscerally. It's like a biological, you know, sort of strong urge if you have made the decision that you want a child. And of course, many women don't, and that's perfectly okay. But if you've already decided you want this, it's a big decision in of itself. And then to be so disappointed, and that sense of absolute deflation when you get the news that it isn't successful. And even those words are really hard: successful, failure, you know, they're the language around it, I think we need to be really careful with as well, because essentially it is very hard not to imagine the positive outcome, especially as this listener said, you know, it looked like it was going well. And that's the thing with IVF and any fertility treatment, is that it can be seen to be going in one way, right? You know, you've got, you know, good eggs, you've got it seems like everything is on target, and then the tables turn quite quickly. And it's the ability to really navigate that journey in a way that you're very aware of the impact that it's having on you. So for this listener, like, I would say that, you know, it is a grief. You know, we're just speaking about grief, but it's a living grief in a sense, if you like. It's a grief that you need to process at the time, because even though this baby maybe never comes to fruition, it is that sense of loss, you know, and it is akin to a bereavement in many senses, because you have to come to terms with it. And that requires, unfortunately, and that's, you know, I suppose personally, it's like I can sit here and be genuinely lighthearted and happy because I've gone through the mud, or I'm, you know, I go through the mud. And that's the only way through. It's like a field, you know, with a beautiful horse on the other side, and you want to get to that beautiful horse, but you've got to go, you've got to walk through the bog and the mud, and you will, you know, you will come out the other side. But with IVF, it's so hard, because what we don't have, you know, the luxury of is this time, because it's like there's no respite from it in terms of, you know, the biological clock is putting pressure on you. So for this lovely listener who's got this news, you know, I would say that when you don't know what to do, whatever situation it is, the best thing is to do nothing, is to give yourself some time to heal and to really allow nature to do its job. You know, we sort of underestimate our ability to heal ourselves, and, you know, tears and feeling, healing is feeling. So going through that emotion is something that will really, really stand to her. It takes courage, it takes strength, but we've got to be so mindful of how important it is to go through it. Because if not, it can lead into all sorts of more chronic, long-term health, mental health concerns.
You're right, because there's so much pressure, isn't there? You know, the biological clock, yeah. You know, everyone's opinions, what you're going through, the financial, the impact on your relationship, all of that was in that letter and in everybody that goes through it. Something I don't think we talk about enough is often we talk about, you know, IVF and fertility, but then people talk about it when they have the baby. And I understand that everybody shares what is okay for them, but we don't talk about the couples or the women who come out the other side and say, I'm not going to have a baby and I'm going to make peace with that. And it sounds like this listener is starting to consider that that may be her future. And I know that sounds really difficult because it's like I'm saying your dream is not going to come true. But I think we do need to start having that conversation about the fulfilled life you can have after that, as you say, when you make peace with the grief of the life you thought you would have.
100%. And it's something that I did myself, is that I made that decision to be content with where I was, not to put myself through it. And that's something I think that only the individual can make. So it's something that the answers, you know, and I say this all the time to my clients, the answer is within you. So you've got to listen to your own voice. And that can, you know, be hard, because it's a noisy world, and you might have a friend who, you know, is saying, oh, well, I'm going again, and my, you know, they went six times and it worked, and, you know, but you've got to know your own body. What are its limits, you know, in terms of physically? What are your limits emotionally? And what are your limits financially as well? You've got to look at the whole picture. And then I think it's really important that you work as a unit, as a couple, you know, because this has an impact on the men, of course, the fathers to be or not, as the case might be. But it's like, how can we grow through this together? Because that is, you know, fundamentally, it is the fulfilled life, you know, and there are plenty of couples who do make peace, who do go on. And, you know, life in of itself is such a precious commodity. And you know, it's that honouring your life and knowing what's right for you. And one of the key sort of mindsets that can help with that, and something I've practiced myself and shared obviously with clients, is that you let go of the attachment to the outcome, and you really focus on that you're doing your best within the, you know, the context and control that you have. And that gives you such a feeling of empowerment, such a feeling of, I know that I did my best within what I'm capable of. And, you know, whatever the outcome, you can walk away or walk towards, you know, your life in a sense of knowing that you have something very, very strong and powerful. And that is your own sense of love and care to yourself.
Can I ask you finally then, any advice on how couples navigate this? Because it's quite hard to be on the same page. With the best will in the world, you're the one taking the hormones, you're the one having the miscarriage, and yet they are also going through all of this. So it's very difficult, isn't it?
It's really, really difficult, to be honest, because, yeah, it can feel like if you're, as you say, you're the one taking all the injections and going on that physical journey as well, it can feel like your partner might not understand. So I suppose that it's like education for men around it, and the impact that this does have on a woman's body, I think is really important. And we need this to be looked at holistically. So, for example, when you go to the fertility clinic, you know, I would be looking at trying to get as much support? Is there particular therapists, counsellors that can help me through this? What kind of self-care program do you have? You know, can we have a discussion where the husband or the partner comes into the room and, you know, is brought up to speed? You know, so much of anything we go through is understanding. And if we can educate and help our partners to understand what it's like, then that's going to make a huge difference. And I would say as well to anyone who's, you know, going through it, to their partner, is to sort of give a lot of leeway if there's irritability, if there's, you know, mood swings or anything, to just give space for that and understand that this is something that's going to be there, because it's only to be expected, really.
But mind them too. They may not look like they are breaking down in it, but they're experiencing it and want to be a parent just as much as you. It's tricky. We wish you all the best. However the outcome goes, mind yourself. You have your retreat in Crete coming up. I can't believe it's nearly the summer again and you're going to be living in Crete. My green eyes are going to be back.
Well, look, I feel like I'm in Crete at the moment. The weather is so gorgeous here and it's really lifting everyone up. So I'm so happy about that. But yes, my 7-day retreat is happening the 23rd of June. This is an amazing opportunity, really, for any person to come on and really experience, I suppose, what it is that the whole content is around the art of living, you know, and how we can essentially live with peace, with joy, and how do we actually bring that into our lives and then bring that home. Because it's easy when you're on a retreat and everything is there for you and catered for you. But what I always do is look at practices and techniques that can actually, you know, really help someone when they return to their challenges, whether it's IVF or grief or whatever a person's going through. We do all have these challenges and need as much support as possible.
Yeah. So 7 days away to focus on how to live well and then ways to bring it in. People can find out more at your website, thepositivehabit.com, and also on Instagram at thepositivehabit. Fiona Brennan, as always, thank you very, very much. And to remind you again, if you have an issue that you would like therapist Fiona Brennan to look at, email us anonymously, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com.
Alive and Kicking on Newstalk.
Now, Nick Sherilambis is Managing Director of Alpha Wealth, a financial advisory firm based in Cork, specialising in providing practical financial advice to individuals and businesses. He's back on the show today to tackle the sticky subject of money and relationships. Nick, you're very welcome back.
Thank you very much again, Claire.
This is a fascinating topic because they do say money can't buy you happiness, but it can certainly bring a lot of stress. And we're going to be looking at all kinds of relationships, not just romantic, but also within friendship and family. But this is something you say you come up against all of the time.
Absolutely, Claire. Most of my interactions with individuals, and I tend to meet a lot of partners, I find that there is this whole kind of dichotomy of those that have very different relationships with money. And interestingly, we had a podcast there a couple of months ago with Dr. Richard Hogan, who mentioned that some of it stems back to our childhood, you know, the way that maybe we were dealing with money through our parents and so in our own households. And I've noticed of late, like I've been a financial advisor for over 20 years now, that there's been a different shift of the way that we treat money. There tends to be kind of this more separate, you know, dealing with our finances, where you have like a couple who will have very separate accounts. And there's no right or wrong specifically, as long as it's seen to be fair. But there's so many different kind of, I suppose, ways that people kind of just behave. And it does, unfortunately, have quite a big impact, not just on the relationship, but even financially, meeting their financial goals and objectives. And obviously buying a house would be certainly a big aspect of helping people to get to their financial goals.
Well, let's leave the romantic relationships to our big finale and let's scoot in first with money and friendships. What's your advice there? My dad's words came into my head, and he used to always say, neither a borrower or a lender be. And he didn't mean, obviously, in the mortgage sense of things or for the car loan. I think he meant in friendship.
No, absolutely. And I remember back many years ago when I had my first job, I worked in London for an investment bank. And I remember there was one employee that used to, you know, ask for a loan. And At the time, it was £20, which going back to kind of 1997 was quite a bit. It was probably the equivalent of about 50 euros. And that money was never received back to me. And it kind of really did affect our relationship. So, but in terms of the way it can behave, and there is this, I suppose, look, keeping up with the Joneses. And I find that there are those that do look over the fence and see the flash car, and trying to keep up with our friends and neighbours can also have financial implications on ourselves. But definitely I've seen relationships break up, families, unfortunately. You know, you've got this scenario where there could be an asset that's even passed to children, you know, adult children in some cases, where it can cause, you know, quite significant problems, just even in a kind of a, what should be a positive sense. So the big problem I find typically is that we find it very difficult even to this day to talk about money just as a nation. And that hasn't really changed, despite the fact that, you know, again, there's a lot more information available through social media and just, you know, platforms. I still think it's something that we struggle with.
My kids are at the age now where they're ringing me to top up their Revolut, and there'll be times when they won't, and they will have been out for an afternoon or whatever with their friends, and I'll say, well, you know, what did you eat or where did you go? And they've been somewhere with a friend, and they'll say, oh, so-and-so just paid. And I will always say, don't be that person, because I think we all have a friend who rocks up to things without money. And even though you won't mind one drink here, one sandwich there, it does imprint on your mind, and it is something that you carry with you.
No, I agree, Claire. And again, there are different types of personalities. There's those that are givers. Like you, I have, you know, children at that age where my daughter's in a relationship now, and it seems that her partner is very given. And like that, I'm a little bit kind of weary of the fact that, you know, you don't want them to have these kind of habits of taking and, you know, not giving back. Now, even when it comes down to just us as individuals and adults, we need to be cognizant of how we manage ourselves, obviously in terms of what personality type we are. I tend to be a giver, and I've learned through experience that you do need to just check in with yourself and find that sort of balance of, you know, okay, you know, what am I prepared to do and give? Because unfortunately then, if you get taken advantage of, which may not be deliberate, it does sometimes cause, obviously, that sort of, you know, I suppose, concern, really.
I've had to do some work in that area as well. You can't give to receive. It can't be transactional. You either do something for somebody or you put a boundary there. That does take a little bit of work, I agree. Let's move on to family then, because money can actually rip families apart, can't it?
Absolutely, Claire. I've seen it happen again and again with families. Now, it's important, if it's possible, to try and prevent that as best we can, you know, and having kind of a will made. And maybe this discussion piece, which can be difficult. Again, we really struggle. And as I say, sometimes when it comes to families, and normally it would be the parents that may have the asset or be able to pass on, whether it's a property, it could be cash, it could be trying to help them, you know, get on the property ladder. And it can have bearings on the other things. And then you've got, obviously, the significance of maybe partners that come into the relationship. So it's not necessarily even the family. It can sometimes be, you know, those other individuals that are also included in the wider circle.
So have those difficult conversations, maybe while, if we're talking about inheritance, your parents are still alive. It sounds like who wants to talk about death and inheritance, but just even your attitude or what people's thoughts are, feelings, it's much better than in a time of grief when perhaps a parent has just died. You're trying to deal with a lot emotionally as well as everything else that comes with it. And then you're trying to match everybody's differing opinions. So have those conversations early, I think, is a really, really good tip. It might not necessarily go the way you want it, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, this is not a plug for financial advisors, but I'd almost see us like financial counsellors. And I've been in many meetings with clients where it's difficult sometimes for that partner, especially, as I said earlier, you know, we have different relationships with money where it could be one of the partners actually wants me as a financial advisor that seemed to be impartial, trying to get a message across to the other person. Now, I try not to take sides, but what you're really trying to do is to be able to portray, you know, information that maybe that person cannot give out. And I think it's really important, I do, especially, as you say, In terms of planning, and a lot of what we do as financial advisors is trying to plan for the future, you need to be able to give time to these things. You know, sometimes it takes a little bit more to do things. For example, as parents, you know, giving money to our children, and I'm not advocating, you know, just handing them pots of cash, but there is certainly an element of trying to help our children. You know, this survey from Leia about how much it actually costs to raise a child in Ireland, I think the average cost is about €170,000. And it's a huge financial expense. And that in itself can actually create problems because one parent may have a slightly different view on how the child should be treated financially to another. And then you've got, you know, the different kind of myriads of other than, I suppose, relationships like grandparents that may always then get in the way as well.
Let's go to the big finale then. Money in your romantic relationships. Because you can have two very different views, as you mentioned already. You may have been raised in, you have been raised in different households, and there may have been very different attitudes to money. And that's what you bring to the relationship. So it can be difficult to meet in the middle.
Absolutely, Claire. And there are new relationships that I come across, and typically what I suggest, and again, there's no hard and fast rule, whether couples decide to keep their finances completely separate, whether they join them or, you know, split them. We were talking offline there about, you know, maybe people who have this kind of 50-50 split towards certain bills. There isn't a right or wrong answer, but what I would suggest is that it's really important to kind of make sure that each partner feels that they are being treated fairly. And also then my small bit of advice would be that if you are looking to buy an asset together, for example, a property, it would be probably a good idea to try and have a joint account where you can have a little bit of transparency, because I've seen relationships where one of the partners is basically going to cause a problem. You know, they may not have their accounts in order. And unfortunately, it gets to a point where they may go to the bank to present themselves that this becomes apparent, and it can cause huge problems. You know, I had a client meeting yesterday with clients that were doing quite well, and yet the bank refused them a mortgage because of some unpaid direct debits that were on one of the person's accounts. And it only transpired during the actual meeting with the mortgage broker. Interestingly, I also meet clients who seemingly on paper are doing extremely well. I had a couple recently that were earning over €250,000 gross between them. And believe it or not, they were struggling financially because of an overspend. One of the parties had taken out loans for cars. They had a particular interest in cars. And they openly admitted that, you know, that it was an expense that perhaps in hindsight probably wasn't the best thing to do. And then the other person mentioned that, you know, they had children who had interest in certain sports, like my own daughter. She was into horses, and that can be a really expensive hobby, especially if it, you know, gets into something that can be a bit more serious. So I think the key thing really is just to try and take account of, you know, your own finances. And like that, it sounds a little bit mundane, but like we say, for all forms of just financial planning, just basic tips, try and do a financial budgeter, try and work out where your priorities lie. And as long as you live within your means, it's okay to spend money on a big family holiday if that's what makes a couple happy. And again, there may be one party that may prefer that over the other. And it's just trying to have that conversation, I think, is really important.
What are red flags financially within relationships?
One of the biggest red flags is the lack of, I suppose, transparency, to the point of, you know, for example, if one party is not seen to be contributing a fair share. Now, again, it doesn't have to be 50-50. I come across a lot of couples where one of the parties could be earning more than the other. And it's a, I suppose, a bit of a contentious topic. You know, should they contribute more than the other party? What if one of the parties is at home, you know, minding the children? And that can feel quite, I suppose, controlled in some environments, and maybe not even deliberately. So some of the red flags for me are where there is this disparity, you know, where one of the persons is, you know, being able to afford the luxuries, if we can call them that, and the other party feels that they don't have the ability to even, you know, buy necessary items. having their own accounts, I think, is really important as well. So, you know, for couples who have, let's say, a joint account, sometimes that can be, unfortunately, not the ideal scenario. I think it's really important for each person to have their own money and be able to feel a little bit of financial independence, even to a small degree. Other ones are, and unfortunately, I've seen this on occasion where some people unfortunately get into kind of gambling, and that provides secrecy. And, you know, if you feel that something isn't quite right, you need to be able to try and address that. And this is where sometimes problems can arise. And before you get too ingrained in a relationship, I think it's quite important to try and just establish, you know, and I've been in a situation previously, you know, I'm married, divorced, remarried. So I've had different types of scenarios. And we are typically meeting people later in life where we're probably more ingrained in our own finances. And probably, if truth be told, a little bit of afraid of combining finances, which sometimes can be effective. But again, it's not about necessarily being able to share everything equally. It's making sure everything's fair. And that's the biggest part. And I do think financial advisors may play a role in that as well.
Yeah, I do. Just even as you're saying it, because it's a sticky conversation, like you said, with the family or a new relationship, why do we wait until we're going for a mortgage before we sit and talk about money and how we're going to do things? If you're going to move in with somebody, say, why don't we go see a financial advisor? Let's see how we can do this as best we can, and let somebody else tell whoever needs to be told the hard truths and iron out any kinks or problems before you end up like that couple that you said, where the red flags had shown up on the credit register and it can tear relationships apart. Nick, fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on. Nick Sherilambis, Managing Director of Alpha Wealth.
Thank you very much, Claire.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan. Rory Galvin was on podcasts, and Hugo Da Silva Scott, who was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.
Life insurers put life into the things you live for. The new factory that's hiring your neighbors. Maintenance on the bridge that keeps traffic flowing. The paycheck that puts pizza night on the table. Life insurers contribute $8 trillion to communities and local economies through bond purchases and other investments, and protect the financial security of 90 million American families, like yours. See how life insurers put life into America at ACLI.com. Paid for by the American Council of Life Insurers.